Special funding for the podcast of On Point is provided by Boston University School of Law, dedicated to excellence in teaching and to preparing lawyers for global challenges.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Israel's attack on Gaza and Hamas had many goals. Stop the rockets, protect Israeli citizens, cripple, maybe topple Hamas, show the world Israel could still hit back, maybe divide the Middle East even more clearly between Iran backers and moderate regimes. So how's that going on day 12 of bombardment? We'll ask the neighbors. This hour on Point, how the Arab world sees Gaza. Joining me first from London is Rula Khalaf, Middle East editor for the Financial Times. Rula, thanks very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom. Thanks.
So how do you see this playing out? What's your sense of Israel's goals and how the unfolding conflict is being perceived? Is Israel getting what it came for?
I think what we can see today is that the Israelis are taking their first more positive diplomatic steps in saying that they're at least interested in the Egyptian initiative, which we first heard about last night,
and
which
seems
to have been worked out.
Mm-hmm.
It's a potential ceasefire. It's still a vague initiative. It starts with a temporary ceasefire, and it's supposed to then move on to talks between Palestinians and Israelis on the details of what a permanent ceasefire would be. It's not clear yet that Israel's interest means that it will accept a temporary ceasefire. It's my impression until now that perhaps they want to talk about it before they decide on it. But obviously, the longer that this goes on, the more pressure Arab governments will be under. Obviously, Egypt is one of the main players here. Mm-hmm. And I think Egypt has been under tremendous pressure in this crisis because Palestinians and ordinary Arabs, the Arab masses, are accusing it of conspiring with Israel against Hamas. At the same time, Egypt has been the main regional mediator in the Arab-Israeli conflict. And everything that it has tried to mediate has essentially collapsed. So I think what it's trying to do now is to try to restore some of its credibility by acting as the leader of the diplomatic front. Mm. This is how I see this, you know, the Mubarak initiative. Mm.
Rula, let me ask
on the
you,
level,
you're watching from London, so you've got the big view. We're going to get even closer to this. We're going to go to Jordan mm-hmm. and Amman. But what about the regional geopolitics here and how this attack has affected relations between moderate regimes in the region and Iran, which has backed Hamas and Hezbollah, how it's affected Israel's relative strength and backing in that equation. Mm-hmm. How do you see that unfolding?
I think that what we call the moderate Arab regimes, who are moderate when it comes to the peace process, who want a peace agreement with Israel, want to see the Arab-Israeli conflict resolved on a peaceful basis, I think that they have been tremendously weakened by this crisis because they confront a population that looks at them and asks, what are you doing for the Palestinians? And what they're doing has not been very much because their ability to influence Israel or to influence the U.S. Has been essentially non-existent. I think we will have to see how this Egyptian initiative plays out and whether it can help breathe some life into this pro-peace, so-called moderate camp. But I think violence in the Middle East and any similar situation, Israeli attacks, tends to play much better into the hands of radical forces in the region. So Israel has tried to portray this as it is us and, you know, Israel and the moderate Arabs against Iran and Syria. But it's not exactly, it doesn't, you know, in reality, this is a bit of an illusion. It doesn't play out that way. And the Arab states, the idea that the Arab states are just going to completely turn against Hamas and that want to crush Hamas, I don't think reflects reality. I think what Arab states have sought to do, although they are not supporters of Hamas, is to return the Palestinians into some form of national unity government, because they cannot be seen to be favoring one Palestinian side against the other.
Well, let me ask
and I
you
think
about
wherever the, mm-hmm. sorry, wherever the, let me just say this, mm-hmm. however the Egyptian initiative plays out, one element of it is going to have to be Palestinian reconciliation. I don't think that it can work without Palestinian reconciliation.
And you mean between Hamas and the more moderate
and
Fatah?
Fatah. Yes.
Well, let me ask you then, because many have described this as a kind of regional struggle, a kind of proxy war here. Israel, obviously, and Hamas right in the middle of it, but Iran supporting Hamas and Hezbollah to the north in Lebanon, Iran threatening the traditional kind of Egyptian and Saudi primacy in this region, in part through Hamas. Do the governments of the so-called moderate states regimes, do they want to see, have they wanted to see Hamas knocked down in Gaza or not?
I think a lot of these states, I think what you're describing is a view that tends to be exaggerated by governments themselves. Of course, these divisions exist. There are two different sets of alliances in the region. But the alliance between the what we call the Arab moderates and Israel is not tight. It is not the same as the alliance between Syria and Iran, for example. Also, the relationship between Syria, Iran, Hezbollah and Hamas, there are different degrees here. Iran and Hamas are not as close as Iran and Hezbollah. Mm-hmm. Syria and Hamas are much closer than Iran and Hamas, for example. Mm-hmm. So when you ask, would the regional heavyweights in the region like to see Hamas crushed? Yes, I think they would. But I think they are not as foolish as to think that you can erase Hamas or that you can actually crush Hamas. There isn't a single Arab official that I speak to who thinks that you're not going to have Hamas after this war.
Rula Khalaf in London, it's so good to have your perspective. Please stand by there, Middle East editor for the Financial Times with us from London. Let's get closer to the arena where there's been so much action and suffering in recent days. Joining us from Amman, Jordan, is Labib Kamhawi. He is Palestinian-Jordanian political analyst, commentator on Al Arabiya, Al Jazeera, CNN, BBC News. Labib, thanks very much for joining us from Amman.
Thank you.
How do you see this turmoil in Gaza, these attacks in Gaza, and the Hamas position there playing out in the Arab world? Is it possible to describe a reaction, or is there a reaction all over the place? How do you see it?
It's basically shock and anger. Most people would sit down and watch TV all the time and wouldn't believe that this kind of carnage can take place in the 21st century. Now, most people do not stop thinking that what is causing all this, what has caused all this, is the fact that these areas are occupied by the Israelis. And because they are occupied, you have all sorts of reactions coming from inside the Palestinian territories, whether they are moderate or extremist or fundamentalist or liberal or whatever you want to call it. But the basic problem is the occupation itself. So people look at Israel as being, and its occupation of these territories as being the cause of all these problems. Now, the fact that Israel is the occupying force puts a lot of responsibility on its shoulders in making sure that people of the occupied territories are looked after, do not suffer, do not fall victims for hunger and anger, whatever you want to call it. Now, if Israel is failed in its duties to create this atmosphere through means like blockading entire areas like the Gaza Strip for so long, then Israel is playing into the hands of Hamas and extremism itself. It cannot blame others for what is happening in the occupied territories as being the fault of the people who are themselves victims of occupation.
Labib, what do you hear now in Jordan to the Israel refrain, which we've all heard, that they have to do this to stop the rockets from coming out of Gaza and landing on Israeli towns and villages and people, that they're there to protect their citizens from the threat of Hamas rockets? What's the response in Jordan?
I mean, even if this was true, which I would dispute, you cannot retaliate by killing infants, killing children, killing civilians, killing women in hundreds and thousands, like what's happening now in the Gaza Strip. You can't justify it by bombarding a whole population day and night for 12 days. Now, you cannot. I mean, the world community cannot give this sort of action any justification whatsoever. Otherwise, it is an invitation for other countries to do the same, and it is an invitation for militant forces to do the same to civilians. People were outraged all over the world because of what happened in the World Trade Center on September 2nd. Now, this is a counterpart of it, but state-sponsored instead of quote-unquote terrorism-sponsored. Now, we don't want to see this happening anywhere in the world. This is why we ask everybody not to give any justification. If the Israelis have a cause to complain, then they should know that they are the force of occupation, not vice versa, not the people of the Gaza Strip. And look at the casualties involved in both cases. I mean, maybe 4 or 5 Israelis were injured, or 1 or 2 were killed. Now you're talking about systematic bombardment of the most heavily populated piece of land on earth. It means that if you throw a bomb, you are assured that you're going to kill people. You're going to kill civilians. You're going to kill children.
Labib Hakam Kamhawi in Amman, please stand by. We'll come back. Challenge, investigate, and we hope learn. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking about the Arab world watching Gaza there. Sound behind us of emergency crews coming to the UN school in Jabalia yesterday, refugee camp in Gaza, where Israeli fire hit and killed a number of people, a considerable number, taking shelter at that school. Protests around the region here from Al Arish in Egypt on Friday over the Israeli attacks. And hear the sound of protests in Kabul, Afghanistan, last Friday. Israel looking to defend its population against rockets out of Gaza, but a whole region watching and coming to its own conclusions about what's going on, a region that neighbors Israel, a region that is vital in many ways and in turmoil in many ways. Let's take a call from Jeff in Montreal, Canada. Jeff, you're on the air.
Yes, hi, Tom. Just 2 quick points, but before I make them, I agree that this is a proxy war. It seems to be a confrontation really between the U.S. and Iran over regional dominance in the Middle East. But I'm just in touch with a good friend in Turkey and Istanbul. There's also tremendous sense of rage and fury, and I think if this conflict continues, it might alienate our allies, our NATO allies such as Turkey. And it also gives the Turks the green light to pursue their bombing campaign against the PKK terrorists, which could perhaps destabilize the region further. And thirdly, it's quite surprising to see the EU as the main leader in the efforts to achieve a ceasefire. So the U.S. seems to be sidelined in this whole a process, which is quite unprecedented.
But Jeff, let me ask you, what should Israel do when the rockets are falling on towns and villages almost randomly? People are dying, not in the numbers they're dying in Gaza right now, but over a long period of time. What should Israel do?
Well, of course, Israel is right to defend itself and its border region, but it also creates the justification for other countries to do the same thing, where there are tensions between Pakistan and India. India may decide to launch its own offensive to stop cross-border terror operations. You see this going on in Turkey for some time. It could lead to a general destabilization in that part of the world. But Israel is definitely legitimately defending its own interests. The question is, at what price to regional stability?
Jeff, thanks very much for your call from Montreal. Let's get one from Boston and Omar. Omar, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I just have a couple of quick comments. Before I respond to the question of what Israel should do in response to the rockets, I want to point out that the so-called moderate Arab regimes, I mean, the word moderate here is really euphemism for being within the U.S.-Israeli orbit. These regimes are definitely not moderate, in that they're dictatorial regimes in which corruption is rampant and torture takes place and so on. And with regard to the peace process in particular, The only difference between them and regimes like Syria is that a regime like Syria and even a group like Hamas is preconditioning an agreement with Israel on full Israeli compliance with international law through a complete end to the occupation. And these regimes like Saudi Arabia and Jordan and Egypt are actually willing to reach some sort of accommodation with Israel without requiring them to end the occupation and without caring much with much consideration about the treatment of Palestinians. Now, the problem with the issue of the rockets is that this entire framework that has been adopted wholesale by American media, that it is Hamas firing rockets and Israel responding, when you look at that equation, it is really difficult to see how somebody can be upset with Israel for responding. But this is not the correct equation. The correct equation is that Israel has imposed a devastating siege on the entire Gaza Strip, causing skyrocketing malnutrition, people dying in the dozens because of lack of medical care, and then Israel itself violating the ceasefire on multiple occasions, as documented by the United Nations. And then when, in response to all of this, Hamas fires a few rockets, then this becomes all of a sudden justification.
Let me ask you, Omar, more than a few rockets, but let me ask you, with Iran backing Hezbollah in Lebanon on Israel's northern border, and Iran and others, Syria, engaged with Hamas there on the south, can you imagine Israelis being open to a two-state solution if they worry that Gaza and the West Bank might turn into rocket launching pads? Is that not a reasonable concern?
How are the Palestinians supposed to feel about the fact that the United States provides $3 billion in military aid to Israel every year? Should they be concerned that a two-state solution might be a launching pad for further Israeli aggression? I mean, the point is, we're seeing a systematic undermining of the two-state solution in Israel's behavior. It is continuing to expand illegal settlements in the West Bank to this day as we speak.
Omar, we've got the perspective, and I appreciate it. Rula Khalaf in London, what about the two-state solution? Everybody seems to agree it's the only way to go. Are we getting closer or further here?
I think there's a bit of confusion here. You raised the question of why would Israel agree to a two-state solution since there'll be rocket fire from the West Bank as well as Gaza. The reason that this is happening is because there is no two-state solution. It's because Palestinians do not have a state. It's because Palestinians are under occupation, even in Gaza. Yes, Israel withdrew in 2005, but Gaza's borders have been sealed. Gaza is like a prison. You cannot get out, you cannot get in, even if you're a student, even if you're sick. So this whole conflict is about how do you provide security to Israel, right? The way to provide security to Israel is to create a Palestinian state. It is to give the Palestinians their right to self-determination. This is what will provide Israel with security.
Israel might say Hamas doesn't accept that, and that's the problem. That's why they're going after Hamas.
Well, that is why what Israel should have done over the last few years is to give more strength to bolster the Palestinian Authority. By moving the peace process forward, you move people away from Hamas and towards the Palestinian Authority of Mahmoud Abbas. Instead, what we have now is the legitimacy of a leader like Mahmoud Abbas has been crushed. And the legitimacy of Hamas does risk. We may very well see Hamas with even more legitimacy.
Let me get
today.
A call.
You have got to move towards a peace solution.
Let me go to Brookline, Massachusetts, and Bill. Bill, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I could not let the words of the speaker in Amman go unchallenged. He spoke about the problem being the occupation. Gaza has not been occupied for years. Is Israel supposed to wait until their schools are hit with children before they're able to retaliate? They hit a school in Be'er Sheva. Thank God no one was there. But if somebody's trying to kill you, you have a right to defend yourself. And the world did not hear anything from the Arab nations when Syria occupied Lebanon for over 25 years. Not a word.
Let me put it to Labib Kahawi in Amman. Labib, you hear the perspective. What's your response?
Yes, I mean, this is playing with words, because the Israelis, when they withdrew from Gaza, they did not offer Gaza independence or sovereignty. They sealed the territories, they took the land away from them and imposed on them settlements, and they treated the people of Gaza as captives, as prisoners. They did not offer the moderate party amongst Palestinians, which is Fatah and Mahmoud Abbas, any concession for peace. And
by doing this, they played straight into the hands of extremists, because Palestinians realized that being moderate does not pay. It would lead nowhere. So they resorted to the other option that was offered to them by Hamas. So if we really want to challenge the fact that who is responsible for the emergence of an organization like Hamas to power in Gaza Strip, it is the Israelis and their negative attitude towards peace in the region. This is why we have to insist that the only solution to this dilemma which we are facing, all of us now, is peace. And the Israelis have to be more courageous and more forthcoming in giving concessions to the moderate parties towards the establishment of a two-state solution in the West Bank and in the whole of Palestine.
Pulling out of Gaza wasn't enough, you're saying?
It was not really a pull out. It was taking out the soldiers and putting them around Gaza.
Labib, stand by, and Willa Khalaf in London. I want to get a perspective from Washington here. The U.S. position ultimately will be a big deal in all this, I guess. Tomorrow, Wittes joins us from Washington, director of the Middle East Democracy and Development Project at the Saban Center for Middle East Policy at the Brookings Institution. Tomorrow, Wittes, thank you very much for being here.
Hello, Tom.
How do you see what's going on in and around Gaza now playing out across the Arab world, if that's a big enough stage? At this point, we have to include Turkey and Iran. But how do you see this playing out in the region?
I'm not sure I would say it's a proxy war, but I would certainly say that this crisis is exacerbating tensions and the split that Rula described, which I would say is not really a split between radicals and moderates. As your caller from Boston pointed out, moderate is a tricky label for some of these states. Mm-hmm. It's really a split between status quo states, those that like the balance of power in the region today, including a major role for the United States in the region, mm-hmm. and actors that are revisionists, that don't like that balance of power and want to change it in their favor. And primary among those revisionists is Iran, which is looking for an expanded role in the region, not just in Iraq and in the Gulf, but also in the Levant. And that's why you've seen increased Iranian activism on the Arab-Israeli front. So the crisis in Gaza allows the actors on both sides of this divide to exploit or to be caught up in the dynamics of this conflict and to try and use it to their own ends.
And so who's making more hay, if I may ask, at this point? The Iranian sort of revisionists who would change the status quo crowd, Egypt, Saudi Arabia, the U.S., who's gaining from this?
Well, I think if you look at the Arab media coverage and if you look at public sentiment across the region, it seems clear that the revisionists are winning. And I wanted to bring in one additional dynamic here, which is that this isn't just for the Arab states about regional politics and regional diplomacy. It's also very much about domestic politics inside Arab countries, because the critiques that people like Hassan Nasrallah or Mahmoud Ahmadinejad make of these traditional Arab leaders like Hosni Mubarak or King Abdullah of Jordan or King Abdullah of Saudi Arabia.
The Hezbollah leader has been very tough on the leadership in Egypt, almost calling for their overthrow in recent days.
Yes, coming right up to the edge of that, mm-hmm. and not just on grounds of Arab complicity with the U.S. and Israel, but also on the grounds of the domestic failings of these states, their domestic repression, their lack of democracy, their inability to provide for their own people, not just for the needs of Palestinians. And so the revisionist critique across the region is resonating with these domestic publics inside Egypt. And that's why you see these tremendous protests. It's an outlet for people to express their opposition, not just to the situation in Gaza, but also to their own governments. And this is really worrying the status quo leaders of the Arab world. It is very difficult for them to engage in the kind of diplomacy they need to engage in with Israel to get a new ceasefire, to push the peace process forward. Mm. They need to do that. But it's hard to do it effectively because the more they do it, the more they look like they are treating with the enemy.
Tomorrow, Wittes in Washington, please stand by. Labib Kamhawi in Amman, Jordan, what about this? We read recently from our old friend Anthony Shadid with the Washington Post, who wrote that he's never seen a bigger gulf between the so-called Arab street, the population, and these status quo regimes that have been generally friendly to the United States, that the anger in the streets over what's happening in Gaza has created a greater alienation than ever before. And tomorrow, Wittes, points to the same thing. Do you see that? Do you hear that? How vividly in Jordan and beyond?
This is very true. It is rare that you see general consensus among the people of the region on issues. And this time you see a clear consensus in expressing suspicion and anger towards the Arab regimes, various Arab regimes, and tacitly or publicly accusing them of cahooting with the Israelis in the war on Gaza. Now, people are manifesting this anger in many ways, but basically it is also directed towards the fact that these regimes are hopeless in terms of realizing the ambitions of their own people, and this is being more and more vocal. But we are witnessing also that other players in the region are becoming more active, like Turkey. And Turkey, it seems, is coming into the fold, not to assist Arab regimes as such, maybe, but to challenge them as well, to challenge their role in the region, because they feel that if they don't fill that vacuum, the Iranians would come in and fill it swiftly. So now we are looking at a situation where the Arab regimes in question are not threatened only by their own people, but also by other forces in the region that aspire to have a leading role in running the affairs of the region.
Tomorrow, what about that? We see the Turkish president, Abdullah Gül, saying in recent days, what Israel has done is nothing but atrocity. Turkey and Israel historically have been relatively close. What's the significance? I mean, we know Turkey has a government of a new complexion in recent years. Nevertheless, this is pretty harsh language from the Turkish president.
It is, although it's not unprecedented. The Turkish government under the AK Party has not shied away from criticizing the Israelis quite harshly in the past when they feel that Israel has usually, in cases where they feel Israel has used force in a disproportionate way. So it's not that much of a surprise, the harsh rhetoric. I would agree with Labib that the very energetic Turkish role in regional diplomacy is new. It's a shift after a long period of time when Turkey didn't want to get mixed up in the affairs of the Middle East. It wanted to orient itself toward Europe. But one consequence of the war in Iraq and the instability that has rippled through the region as a result is that a state like Turkey realizes it can't really escape from its geographical position in the Middle East. And given that the Arab states, especially Egypt, which traditionally has been the regional diplomatic leader, are really between a rock and a hard place, between these radical regional forces and their own domestic public opinion, they are disempowered. And so Turkey's trying to fill the vacuum, I think, in a fairly constructive way, both in this crisis and in its mediation of the peace talks between Israel and Syria.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the Arab world watching Gaza. We've been joined from Amman by political analyst Labib Kamhawi, there from London by Rula Khalaf, Middle East editor for the Financial Times, and from Washington in the Brookings Institution by Tamara Wittes, director of the Middle East Democracy and Development Project at the Saban Center there. Lots of coverage all around the world. Unbelievable coverage, just nonstop coverage across the Arab world and the region, just to get a sense of how it's playing and how this turns into a propaganda war, of course, at the same time that it's a report on realities. Here's a clip from the Iranian government-owned Al Alam TV yesterday. It's narrated over footage of Gazan families digging in debris, bloody bodies being rushed into hospitals.
On the 11th day of the Israeli war, words cannot describe the scene in the Gaza Strip. One massacre after another. Even the UN refugee centers are being targeted. Raids and bloodshed during the night and during the day. Martyrs in the northern strip, Gaza City, Nusayrat, Deir Bella, Wadi Braid, Khan Yunis, and Rafah. An entire family was buried under the rubble of its home.
Iranian television, the images are nonstop. Let's take a call from Wilmington, Vermont. Barry, you're on the air.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi. It's very hard to be dispassionate about this whole thing, and I'm going to try, but I think that it's so easy to lose sight of what some of the basic issues are. I think one of the basic issues is that as long as Muslims feel that Israel as a Jewish state is an occupying entity in the midst of their world, there's going to be a problem. And I think you have to back up from the scenes in the ER, which are tragic, to realize that Iran right now, like the woman in Washington said, is fomenting this whole thing, using this propaganda extremely effectively, and it's essentially along the same issue of Muslim fanatical or fanatical Muslim intolerance of Jews' right to be in the Middle East.
But, of course, the images are, I mean, they're also reality. These are people, fighters, women, children.
It's tragic. It's tragic. But who is fueling the fire? Iran is fueling the fire via Hamas. Hamas is lobbing shells. What if Mexico City was lobbing shells into Texas?
Barry,
let
us pick it up. Rula Khalaf, what do you say to Barry in Vermont?
I think that this is a very easy way of getting emotional about the conflict. But you have to look. This is not about Iran using Hamas. This is about Hamas. It is about Israel. It is about occupation. It's about the Arab-Israeli conflict. It's the fact that there is no peace in the region. It's too easy to just blame this on outside forces all the time, because it gets us away from realizing what is the crux of the matter here. And it is the Arab-Israeli conflict. It is the Israeli occupation. So I would suggest to Barry that he needs to take another much closer look.
Tamara Wittes, what about it? Tom Friedman writing in the New York Times today that maybe it's no longer the Arab-Israeli confrontation. Iran, of course, not Arab, but Persian, that it's grown beyond that, and we have to reconsider the old parameters of how this very conflict is understood. What do you say, Tamara?
It seems to me that there are two distinct conflicts here, and that they relate to one another, but we need to distinguish them analytically. There is an Arab-Israeli conflict, and more specifically a Palestinian-Israeli conflict, that the international community and the two main parties agree needs to be resolved diplomatically. And I hope that when this crisis is over, we will be able to get back onto that path. There is also an attempt by radical ideological voices to take advantage of this conflict and use it on behalf of their broader conflict with the West, with status quo Arab states, and to just make hay out of that. And, you know, we saw yesterday a new tape released by Al-Qaeda in which Ayman al-Zawahiri is making hay out of the Gaza conflict, calling on Palestinians, saying, we will help you wherever we can in the world, using it as an excuse, in other words, for terrorism, and calling on Egyptians to rise up against Mubarak. That's not about Palestine, and it's not about Palestinian rights. That's about Al-Qaeda and its own goals, using this conflict very cynically.
Let me ask you about that, then. If Al-Qaeda is making hay out of the attack on Gaza and Hamas, what does that mean for U.S. interests here? Does it follow from that U.S. interests are set back by this, if Al-Qaeda is gaining from this?
Well, Al-Qaeda is trying to gain. Whether it succeeds or not, I think we don't know. But what we can say already is this. If President-elect Obama had hoped to come into office, take stock of a relatively calm situation on the Arab-Israeli front, and then choose his time and place for a new diplomatic initiative that would bring new energy to Arab-Israeli diplomacy and that would help to rebrand the American role in the region, he has lost his opportunity to do that because of this crisis. And he's now going to have to come in a crisis management mode and be immediately confronted with some of the worst consequences of this stalemate that persisted through most of the last 8 years.
I want to look more closely at that Obama challenge, but let me get a couple more calls here first. Akhil in Cambridge, Massachusetts, you're on the air.
Hello, Tom.
Hi.
I guess my question is for Labib, is that correct?
Labib Gamhawi in Amman, yes.
Labib, my question is, when does the Arab world look to Hamas and say, stop you know, lobbing shells over into Israel, and the conflict, you know, at least this conflict can be over, and we can be able to move forward with the question of a Palestinian state.
Labib?
Yes. This is one way to look at it, but I tell you something very, it's basic now. It's not anymore ideology that is the core of conflict between the Arabs and the Israelis. It is occupation. The fact that Arabs accepted two-state solution means that the ideological part of the conflict is over. This is why you cannot look at Hamas as being something that is very in harmony with this development. It is a little bit off course, but still, it is the only way left for Arabs because the Israelis have systematically refused any peace initiative and did not really honor any commitment in the direction of giving the Arabs or the Palestinians some concessions on land. Now, you cannot expect the Hamas or Palestinians at large to trust Israelis by word, they want deeds now, they want action. So something more has to come up from the Israeli side to convince Palestinians that there is something serious coming up and that it is worth sacrificing and testing. Now, this is not happening at all, and the fact that the Palestinians are being bombarded day and night is not helping. It's not helping at all. I mean, people will not get mad at Hamas because of this. They will get mad at the Israelis and maybe at the Arab regimes, at the American administration, at European countries, but not really at Hamas. They feel affinity with Hamas. They feel that both are victimized and both are subjected to a carnage that is unprecedented in modern history.
Labib, let me get another caller on the issue of Hamas. Rory in Belmont, Massachusetts. Rory, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
Tom, I have two comments for you today, and they both concern the treatment of this subject in the Western media.
Okay.
What I see is I'm a student of the conflict. I lived in the Middle East for 8 years, West Bank, Gaza, and Jordan.
Mm-hmm.
And what I have seen is a media which seems to take on Israel's talking points and just parrot them endlessly so that they become fact. And I'll give you two examples.
Are you talking about American media or what media?
I'm talking about American media primarily, but Western media in general.
Okay.
But I'll limit it to American media if you like. And the two examples are the ceasefire, which everyone seems to think was started by Hamas, but there's a lot of gray there.
You mean the six-month ceasefire that fell apart last month?
Correct. Mm-hmm. During that ceasefire, 22 Palestinians were killed in Gaza. Gaza was sealed off for more than 70 days, completely sealed. And these were, you know, these are violations of the ceasefire. But my other point mm-hmm. is the treatment of Hamas and the Islamic movements generally. You know, we talk about them as though they are monolithic, single entities coordinated from Damascus or Tehran.
When you say Islamic movements, do you mean fundamentalist movements, Islamist movements, or what do you mean exactly, Rory?
Well, let's take Hamas and Hezbollah, for example.
Mm-hmm.
These are incredibly diverse organizations with a very solid base that's built on things like healthcare services, schools, security. These are grassroots organizations, and their political leadership reflects that. They are not, you know, they're not single issue organizations bent on the destruction of Israel.
But they do also have ideology and goals.
Correct, and these are organizations that have a diversity of opinion within them.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea that you know, you cannot talk to Hamas because they, you know, are you finish the sentence, just doesn't carry water. We need to be talking to these groups. We need to be coming to an accommodation with them. I don't know how you come to accommodation with your enemies when you don't talk to them.
Rory, let me pick that up with Rula. Our time is short. I appreciate your perspective. Rula Halaf, what about it? Can Hamas be a negotiating partner just for Israel, for starters, toward a two-state solution, or is it just not going to be part of that? It's clearly prepared to fight.
Well, Hamas has been indirectly talking to Israel. As I mean, you might remember 6 months ago, Hamas and Israel were working through Egyptian mediators, and an agreement was reached on a ceasefire. And in the first few months, I've heard Israeli officials saying that they've been surprised by the level of commitment to the ceasefire. So I think, yes, it is possible. I think what we have now, though, is an Israeli attitude that says Hamas, as far as we're concerned, was never legitimate and is even more illegitimate today. And I think what Israel is now looking for is a way of going completely around Hamas in order to reach a ceasefire. They want their interlocutor to be the Palestinian Authority and not Hamas. So I think while a lot of people thought that Israel would slowly move towards talking directly to Hamas, what we've seen now is the exact opposite. So I think it's going to be very difficult after the conflict to go back to that evolution that we were kind of seeing.
Let's go to Najib in Nashville, Tennessee. Najib, you're on the air.
Yes, Tom. Thank you so much for taking my call. I'm listening. I'm watching news these days, and I'm really, really worried about the civilian in between because I'm against Hamas's rocket fire to Israel, and I'm against also Israelis excess force in Gaza, and the civilian are dying between. And then the peace talk and international, you know, negotiation never work, never last. And what I would say, the international community, the EU, the United States, need to stand fairly, equally to these two countries and bring them to, you know, take tough action on this, even attraction. That way, these two sides will stop and, you know, the bloodshed will eliminate.
Najib, thank you very much for your call. Tamara Wittes, what about it? You say Obama is now facing a tough situation. Is there no longer room for tough, even-handed pressure toward a two-state solution? Is the time really past for that? Isn't that still the path for American pressure, if there is one?
I think in the longer term, yes, that is absolutely the path to a resolution of this conflict. But it's going to be difficult to get from where we are now in the midst of this crisis and this violence to effective negotiation. So the step in between is the ceasefire, and that's what's being negotiated right now. One of your callers asked, why aren't the Arab states sitting on Hamas to get them to stop this rocket fire? And I wanted to just add to the mix that, in fact, the Arab states and the ones that we've been talking about that are most endangered by this crisis, Egypt and Saudi Arabia, have been working very hard to put pressure on Hamas. The problem is, as Labib was pointing out, every day this conflict goes on, Hamas is gaining politically in sympathy. It's gaining support among Palestinians and around the region. So even though it's taking a hit militarily, it's winning politically, and that means it doesn't have a lot of incentive right now to bow to the pressure put on it by these Arab states and help them out of their dilemma.
If that's so true, why would Israel keep this up? They got a front row seat. They can see that. They're no fools.
It takes two to tango. And I think Israel, having gone into this saying that unceasing rocket fire is unacceptable, is going to have a hard time climbing down from the tree without a cease to the rocket fire.
And Rula, what about Egypt? We heard about, you know, sealed borders, but one of those sealed borders is Egypt's border with Gaza. Why haven't they opened up, and opened up in recent days more, to the civilians in Gaza?
Well, what you hear from Egypt, of course, is that they are bound by an agreement that says that the Rafah border, the border between Egypt and Gaza, can only be open when the Palestinian Authority is there and when there are European monitors. They are no longer there, at least not since Hamas took over, ousted Fatah and took over Gaza. So I think that is one reason. But I think the real reason is that they are worried that they will have, that they'll be flooded by refugees. And Egypt always suspects that Israel, what Israel has in mind is to try to sort of dump Gaza and the whole problem of Gaza and of Gaza residents onto Egypt. So Egypt is extremely resistant to taking on any responsibility. But I think in any ceasefire deal, this border, this is a very, very important part of a ceasefire deal. If you listen to Israelis today, they say this is the key to a ceasefire, is how do you try to seal that border?
We're not going to solve this today, but we've had terrific insights from all of you, and I'm grateful for that. Rula Khalaf, Middle East editor for the Financial Times, joining us from London. Thank you very much for being here, Rula.
Thanks, Don.
Tamara Wittes with the Brookings Institution in Washington. Tamara, thank you for joining us this hour.
Good to be with you.
And Labib Kamhawi, political analyst in Amman, Jordan. Labib, thank you. Thank you very much for being here.
Thank you very much.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.